presentation today after having gone through a formal process of consideration of this document at an intersectoral level of DGs. To date, which means during the 2010 financial year, we've had two ISCCJ meetings. The first one was really to strengthen the governance matters around the management of the Child Justice Act. And then the second meeting concentrated more on the policy framework as well as the accreditation framework as is required by the legislation. We have agreed, given the volumes of work, even though the legislation requires us to meet twice per annum, we've resolved to meet on a quarterly basis just to get all the administration of the legislation out of the way. And also to prepare for the key critical steps and milestones that are provided for in the Act. So we will be meeting on a quarterly basis. We have strengthened our secretariat by the addition of one member from the NPA so that we have an effective secretariat that helps us support the national policy framework. Chair, let me apologize to this House. What we thought we would have done is we thought we would have circulated the documents because we had anticipated that we would have received the internal process approvals from the Minister. Through our own processes, that has failed us, and as a result, we were very late with the documents, and we apologize. We will not do it again. As the Chair has indicated, social development, if requested by the committee, has circulated a document, which is the accreditation framework. We will talk to it, even if we do not give a detailed presentation, but we'll just talk to it at high level. And then we probably may have to come back to deal with the details of that document as well, if the members so require. The detail of the presentation, Chair, are going to be dealt with by Ms. Pat Moodley. And then we will interject during the discussion phase of the document. Thank you very much, Chair. Ms. Mook.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. Thank you, DG. The National Policy Framework, in terms of the Act, the DG's ISCCJ must develop a National Policy Framework, and there are four basic objectives that this national policy framework must meet. And I'm just going to go through those and then we'll talk about how we're going to do the rest of the presentation. Well, now I need, sorry, there's slides as well. Whether I should wait for those. The national policy framework needs to ensure a uniform, coordinated and cooperative approach. And I think here the most important thing that the Act, we need to give effect to what the Act requires us in respect of cooperative governance of the Act. And the fact that, there must be proper intersectoral coordination. The National Policy Framework must guide the implementation and administration of the Child Justice Act, promote cooperation and community with the non-governmental sector and civil society, because many services that are provided to children in conflict with the law are actually provided by civil society and the non-governmental sector. And the cooperation between government and non-governmental sector in this respect needs to be properly coordinated or monitored. Enhanced service delivery as envisaged in this Act, by the development of a plan within available resources. And here, it's to ensure that all children receive equal services. And we accept fully that this will be an incremental realization of this particular objective, but ultimately that's what we must aim to do, to ensure that all children receive equal services. The outline of the Child Justice Policy Framework, I think copies of the document have been given to you, and you will see that that's basically the contents page there. And I'm going to start going through it with you. The background to the Child Justice Act, talks to how the Act was actually, the process that we went through in getting to the Act, and then the context and the vision of the Act, and then the introduction of the policy framework, which once again speaks to the objectives that I've just covered. And then that first bit of it ends with the fact that the NPF is located within the broad objectives of the Act, and those are listed here. And very quickly, protecting the rights of the children in the Constitution, protecting the spirit of Ubuntu, and then the intersectoral cooperation, and making sure that children are not exposed to the adverse effects of the formal criminal justice system. Then in respect of implementation of the Child Justice Act, firstly, we need to ensure that service delivery is based on the priorities identified. Secondly, that each government department fulfills its mandate and partners with civil society and NGOs in implementing the Act. And here we have a section on the roles and responsibilities of the various government departments. And then thirdly, that the handover of responsibility towards children in conflict with the law between departments is regulated and well managed. And here, managing intersectoral coordination. So for each of these conditions on which the implementation of the Act depends, the National Policy Framework actually picks out factors that will support it. For instance, the priorities of the Act, and 9 key priorities are identified here. Capacity in the sector, although the sector has been running now for many years, and we've spoken about this previously because we've had the protocol for the management of children awaiting trial in operation for quite a few years, capacity has been built. However, we do need to beef up human resources and ensure that those people are skilled in doing this work. So you will see in reading that particular section that there's a child justice reference committee that has been established, and a training manual has been developed which will be used intersectorally to do training. And then also it goes on to identify the fact that training and capacity building is not only the preserve of government departments, and that diversion service providers, as I spoke to earlier, are often the NGO sector, and we need to ensure that capacity is built within that sector to ensure that services are provided for children when they need it. And you will see that when the presentation on the accreditation for diversion services is presented later on, that's one aspect of empowering civil society to render these services to children. The second very important priority in the implementation of the Act is that children must be assessed timeously. And here there's an obligation on the various government departments involved to ensure that children are assessed timeously before they are taken to the preliminary inquiries. The third priority is the preliminary inquiries. As we've indicated previously when we were discussing the Act and the implementation plan, the preliminary inquiry is a new procedure that has been introduced into the system. And the objectives of the inquiry are set out there. We didn't go into the roles of the various role players here and the responsibilities of the various role players here. It does come up later, however. Sentencing is the fourth priority, and once again sets out the basis for the sentencing of children within the criminal justice system. 5, the provision of diversion and alternative sentencing services. This is the part that where we need to strengthen diversion service providers and programs, And more of this will come up when the accreditation framework is presented to you later. Establishment of child and youth care centres. The Department of Social Development is responsible for the provision of child and youth care centres, and it is a priority for the department to now concentrate on building an additional 18 child and youth care centres in the province. This is imperative because as we move away from the holding of children in prison whilst awaiting trial or in police cells whilst awaiting trial, we have to make sure that there are alternative services available. And this being built into the policy will ensure that that will be done. The establishment of one-stop child justice centres, this is what is provided for in the Act. And you know, we've talked about how we're going to achieve the establishment of one-stop child justice centres previously, and the lack of resources, unfortunately for us in this financial year and probably the next financial year, is going to hinder us. But we have begun talking to donors in respect of establishing one-stop child justice centres. I think our aim for now is to make sure that there is at least one in each province immediately. Resources and budget. We have given our obligation under treaty law, and we therefore do feel pressure to, you know, to be able to deliver on some of these priorities that have been identified. And currently what is happening is that departments are working within their existing budgets and reprioritizing within budget allocations to ensure that we can deliver these services to children. Public education and communication. We need to prioritize awareness raising and communication to all those affected, particularly children. And you know, we need to make sure that the people out there understand that there is a separate justice system for children that holds children accountable, and that ensures that the best plan for that particular child, taking cognizance of that child's circumstances, will be made available for that child. And then finally, the development of the necessary IT and IJS systems to support information. This needs to be prioritized, and I'm going to speak to it a little bit later under another heading. As I said right at the beginning, before we got down to the priorities, and we're talking about the conditions that the implementation of the Act depends on. The first one was service delivery is based on the priorities, and we talked to that. The second one is that each department fulfills its mandate and partners with civil society and NGOs in implementing the Act. And here we thought it was absolutely necessary to spell out the roles and responsibilities of the various government departments. And all the government departments have been party to this document, have made input into this document, and accept that these are the roles and responsibilities of each of the departments. The NGO sector has also participated in the finalization of this document, and you'll see that the very last paragraph under that section speaks to the NGOs' roles and responsibilities. And then the final condition is the handover of responsibility towards children in conflict with the law between the departments is regulated and well managed. And here it's managing intersectoral coordination. And that section, under that heading, which I'm now on page 23, we speak to the governance issues in respect of the DG's ISCCJ and the operational ISCCJ, and there's a diagram there that speaks to the reporting lines of both of these bodies. And We then do a chart on the management of the flow of children through the system. And once again, all government departments have inputted into this, and we accept that those are our roles and responsibilities in the flow, in managing the flow of children. And I think page 28 is of particular importance because it spells out the non-negotiable principles of intersectoral cooperation. And the little chart at the bottom shows you the overlapping where government departments need to share the responsibility for certain functions that need to take place. And I think very importantly for us here is that the child must go through the system in a manner that appreciates the fact that this is a child that we're dealing with and that takes cognizance of the best interests of that child. And finally, that the case flow management principles that have been agreed upon are also applied in every single case where a child is involved. And then on the next page, and that's page 29, we've actually thought it necessary to put out a table that speaks to the maximum time frame for the management of cases involving children. And this is because in the past, various of us have been guilty of the fact that the time limits come and go and children are still in the system. So this sets out very clearly whose responsibility it is to manage that particular, where that particular child is in the flow through the system and what the prescribed period of time is for that function to happen. And we thought that this will be a very important tool also when we're training the various government officials, that we understand not only what our own responsibility is, but what somebody else's, the next person in the chain, what their responsibility is, and why it is important for you to accomplish what you need to accomplish on time. And then finally, the monitoring and evaluation and information management. The Act actually tells us what needs to be managed, what aspects needs to be managed, because those are the aspects that we need to report to Parliament on within a year after the implementation of the Act. And UNICEF has identified a set of indicators under which they want child justice, or as they call it, juvenile justice, to be managed, because they find that when countries report on the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and they're dealing with child justice issues, for instance, we all report on different things, and it's very difficult for them to manage the input that comes in. So the United Nations has given a directive to countries that are signatory to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on, as I say, they call it juvenile justice indicators. Remember, we've moved away from juvenile to child justice. But we've decided that we will use those same indicators as well when we're formulating our reports, because we need to comply as a country when we're providing country reports. And then in respect of the collation of data, we will use the National Operational ISECJ to collect data. And each government department, we're currently working with a gentleman from TAO to put together for us that template, which we need to use as government departments and to report on. And we'll use the operational ISECJ to manage this and through our monthly meetings make sure that we're getting the data that we should be getting. The Department of Justice also has the National Operations Center, NOC, which has incorporated a number of the relevant indicators into a reporting tool already. We want to see whether we can use that tool or whether that tool needs to be amended for the collation of justice data. And then finally, when we have, we hope eventually to have a system where we can take all the information that the different government departments give us and incorporate this into the integrated justice system, or the IJS database. As part of the monitoring and evaluation, the DG's ISCCJ can also commission research on various aspects of the Act. The one that we are compelled to do in terms of the Act, of course, is to review the age of the minimum age of criminal capacity, and that report needs to be submitted 5 years from the coming into effect of the Act. The National Policy Framework then sets out the registers that this Act requires, and those are set out in the document. And then the final section of the National Policy Framework is the legal framework and speaks to our international and regional instruments that we are a party to, and then the various laws that South Africa has passed that have a bearing on the implementation of the Child Justice Act. And then finally, there's a page on conclusion, and we thought it also necessary to then list the abbreviations and the glossary of terms in this document. Thank you.
Thank you.
That last slide, the DG will speak to the process after today. And then
after today, by the 31st, at least not by the 31st, but between now and the 31st, and there will be a formal tabling of this document by the minister. And then thereafter, once the publication process begun and the parliamentary process has begun, we will collate all the comments that will come from the members of the public and all interested and stakeholders, and then compile a final document, which we will then use almost as our Bible to process the issue of children, but also focusing on the issue of children in conflict with the law, but also focusing on the capacity that needs to be created to support and protect the children in conflict with the law. Chair, I may add that since the 1st of April, we had in the last portfolio committee where we dealt with the issues of child justice in the final approval of directives and regulations, we had indicated that intensive training was going on in various sectors that are supporting the Child Justice Act. And that training is ongoing. The Justice College is training the clerks of court as we speak. Last week, Thursday and Friday, we were training the magistrates countrywide. But they were all centered in Pretoria for the purposes of training. So we are rolling that out. The prosecutions are doing the same thing. The probation officers from the social development standpoint are also being trained. So in the end, Chair, we are running this vehicle, fixing it as we go along, so that by the end of this year, we should have the right level of data, even speaking to the type of training that is necessary to implement the this policy framework as well as the legislation. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions? Comments? JJ?
Yeah. Look, I unfortunately haven't had a chance to study the document. We had just wanted it in terms of the Act tabled. It hasn't been tabled yet formally, so I don't know if it is possible to make amendments or whether it's better to let the process run. I mean, it has to be tabled by Monday, so it's probably not possible. Let the policy run and we maybe revisit it. I mean, the control over the policy framework is with the department, with the ministry, not with us. But having said that, I mean, there are some areas that one thinks I would have thought could be made clearer. I think it's useful. I mean, the one difficulty with a hearing like this is the NGO sector with children is very well developed, and that's one of the aims of the policy framework. It's a pity that they're not here, because when one deals with a policy matter, it's very easy to deal with the theory. The practice is something else, and the child justice NGOs often have, well, not often, generally have much greater practice. But the types of fault lines that one is aware of, maybe just to start with I think the way you've structured it is good. On the one-stop child justice centres, you've got two. You've got one in Bloemfontein, which I haven't visited, but my understanding was sort of just set up, and that is functioning. I know the committee members who did visit it were very impressed. You've got then one specially built one, which is in Port Elizabeth, which is non-functional, or at least was when we were there. And that's why we wrote into the Act, or to the Bill at that stage, that they must meet regularly or something like that, because they were suing each other, the different government departments. I mean, it was sort of quite ridiculous. So I would want to suggest that there should be an element either under the one-stop justice centres or the responsibilities of each department to ensure the proper functioning of those centres. Because PE was really it was sad that this was the one that was the pilot, had all the money, all the budgets, and they couldn't work properly, whereas Mangaung, they basically set it up themselves, and it was working. So something dealing with that. Then on the roles and responsibilities, there's things like, and one would want more time to give more detail, but, you know, your point to explaining to the child offender and the child's parent that the child offender has a right to legal representation. And it does go on to say that legal aid, if the family doesn't have their own legal representative, then LAWSA will assign a legal representative. But it's actually more than a right. The child has to have, it's not an option, the child has to have a lawyer, whether they like it or not. And the issue should be phrased like that, that explaining to the child and the child's family that the child, in terms of the law, has to have a lawyer. They can, bring their own, they can use one through LAWSA, but if they refuse, they're going to have one allocated anyway by the court. Then there's things like with social development, and I know they're coming later, but one of the problems on one is, their responsibility is to provide a probation officer to conduct an assessment. Now, from my limited experience of one visit, and that was Uppington, the problem was that the probation officers did not see that they had to go and visit the police stations and visit the children in the police stations. They wanted to do the assessment when the child came to court. So I think that it would have been better to have specified the time limits, that this must be done within the 48 hours, and must be done at the police station. So something more explicit like that. And then also both the police and possibly the probation officers. I mean, it's something I've noticed in a number of stations. The police regard the 48 hours as the requirement. Let me phrase it this way, that you must bring, the law is you must bring them to court within 48 hours. But the way the police respond often is, okay, we're this child was arrested today. Okay, they don't have to go to court tomorrow, they only have to go to court the next day. And because it's 48 hours, whereas somewhere this policy should say, particularly in the case of children, bring them to court as soon as possible. Okay, obviously after the assessment and everything must be done, but it needs to go, they can't be brought to court for the preliminary inquiry until the assessment has been done by the probation officer, but that's why also under the DSD thing, it should really specify the urgency. My worry is it's not there. Then under correctional services, if you go to prison, I mean, it's detain and manage children awaiting trial and sentenced children separately from adults. Now, the whole purpose of the Act is to ensure that children are not awaiting trial in prison unless there are exceptional circumstances. And there's nothing here which says that the correctional services officials must monitor these children coming to them, because mistakes happen, and they happen all the time. You go off to any prison and you look, ask to see the awaiting trial children, and you find a whole lot of kids who quite frankly should not be there. So it there's nothing here directing correctional services to evaluate the children coming in, and if they feel that a mistake has been made by the court, that a magistrate has not applied his or her mind properly, to then take it up. But it's basically here, they're just on the receiving end, taking these children in, doesn't matter if it's right or wrong, and so on. So just, there were areas that I thought could be stronger. The Lawser issue on the preliminary inquiry, I mean, I see that they're still arguing for more money to represent at the preliminary inquiries. And the reason we didn't put it in the Act was often lawyers can delay, even Lawser lawyers, and we wanted to get the preliminary inquiry done quickly, within 48 hours, so that if the child could be removed and put on and diverted immediately, that could happen, rather than the child hanging around in the system because a lawyer couldn't be found. So my argument would be that there's not much chance of substantial injustice through lack of legal representation, but I just think maybe that's something we need to monitor more with them. And then, so those are just sort of some comments, but one would like to make more. I think the important thing is going to be the monitoring, and it would be useful for us as the committee to get reports regularly, maybe quarterly, of how it is going. We already saw in the glare of the media the Eugene de Blanche case, where the NPA wasn't that good in terms of at least the way it was reported in the media. You had the prosecutor or the NPA saying that even though the child was 15, I think, that the capacity question still had to be looked at. I mean, there's no capacity question if they're over 14. One other aspect is the children under 10, because we've raised criminal capacity. I'm worried with, and that's a DSD responsibility, but I'm worried that needs to be given focus, because if you have some delinquent 9-year-olds who are not then, who can't fall into the criminal justice system, but are then not being looked after by DSD and the children's court, that's going to be a problem and may lead to vigilantism as in some countries. So I think also there should be a focus on that. But I think it would be useful, maybe this is then not on the policy document. I mean, what I'm then feeling is the 31st is Monday. Let's maybe have an opportunity to relook at it. We've had it formally, we've had it informally tabled. Maybe involving the NGOs, we could be, I don't know, you've got to review it within a year, 3 years. So maybe from the DG we could get exactly when do you think the public can comment for, the public process, and if we can slot a hearing in along that line where we can make input, so that we can then make input to the department as the committee sort of properly having considered, and it would be useful. I'd really like to hear from the child NGOs, because they're the ones that apply it. So, Chair, sorry, that's a bit of a mouthful, but those would be some comments. But I think it would also be useful, okay, they put the indicators, for us to also come with what we feel the indicators should be, and maybe even spot checks on the prisons. What is the situation with children on awaiting trials in prisons, because they shouldn't be there. Oh, maybe one other point, there was a concern from that when the NPA came before us, that they were talking about a trial as an exception, whereas it's not an exception. Going to prison, being sentenced to imprisonment would be the exception. But they seem to have the attitude that all children were going to get diverted, and that's wrong. We want as much as possible to be diverted, but the serious cases must go to trial, and they could also still get a a supervisionary sentence. But just to monitor that aspect.
Michael, please, another one.
Thank you, Chair. Just two worries that I have regarding the looking after of children once the diversion orders have been granted, and that is placing them under home-based supervision, and also I must just find the exact number. Sorry, I had my finger on it and now I've just lifted it. But basically, Chair, what I'm saying is I was at the Pretoria Magistrates Court last week, Thursday, for something completely different, and landed up speaking to people in the court, and I was very happy to find out that they had been briefed on the Child Justice Act and what was going on there. I was also very happy to see at the Pretoria Magistrates Court that they had a fully functioning child court, as well as a special sexual offences court, which was fully equipped with anatomical dolls and everything like that. So I must tell you, I was impressed with that. But in course of conversation, something came up which I don't think we've thought of as a committee, and that was this. There are so many child-headed households in South Africa that there will be children coming to courts that simply do not have parents because their parents are deceased. You have situations where an entire family, there is no one to look after these children, hence the reason these children become the head of the households. And apparently what is happening is, for a very nominal fee, these kids can get someone from the areas in which they live to come to the courts and pretend to be a family member. The courts, obviously, there are no birth records, there are no ID documents, so it's very difficult to prove whether this person is in fact a relative of the child or not, short of doing DNA testing, which I think we all know would never happen. And these children are then released into the custody of these people who claim to be their family, and then what happens is these kids realize that they're in trouble. They are so worried that they might land up in jail and there'll be no one to look after the smaller kids in the house that they, quite frankly, just disappear. They might go from Johannesburg to Cape Town, where, let's face it, kids grow up, their appearances will change, and we'll never find these children again. So that was the one element that was brought up, which I don't think that we actually ever thought of, and we must take into account, is the effect of child-headed households in our country. Chair, the second thing that came up, and as you know, it's my personal interest, is the issue of human trafficking. Apparently, around the courts, let's face facts, courts are breeding grounds for where criminals hang around, unfortunately. And apparently a lot of human traffickers will find out that these children are in trouble. And let's face it, when kids are in trouble, they get scared. They will leave the court vicinity, go home, whatever, and then these human traffickers will go up to these children and say, listen, you're in a lot of trouble, and you're going to land up in jail, never mind what they say to you. So you better come with us. And now look, I'm fully aware that we cannot stop this kind of thing happening. It is very difficult, short of following these kids home and having personal bodyguards for them. But I think these are just a couple of elements that we must keep in mind, is that the worst of the worst of society tries to prey on these children, especially when they know they're in a situation where they are scared and they are vulnerable. And in a case, you know, especially the case where these children are head of the household, they will literally do anything in their power to stop them from being taken back to court, because they are so worried that they will be taken into custody and their younger brothers and sisters taken away from them.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think whilst one feels quite educated by a number of issues that Honourable JJ raised, and including the Honourable Michaels, I'm just curious about taking into account that we are in a process of remedial intervention. This is what we're dealing with now. I'm not sure how vigilant are we in ensuring interaction between this and feeding to the prevention one. What I'm trying to say is that before this situation, a child commits whatever it is, if there is any dynamic interaction so that these processes, they feed to each other. Because this is an intervention of the last protocol, of the last resort. A lot of resources need to be put to go that. I'm just curious to know how dynamic is the interaction there. And the other issue, Chair, is I'm also impressed generally, in spite of the very enlightening issue that Honorable Digger said, that it's quite encouraging to see that roles are clearly put there. the process flow, and all these issues. At least the key elements that require an intention to implement effectively are there, but the improving each and everyone in detail is going to be an ongoing process. But if I want to come lastly to what Honourable Mike has said, is that I think that one is a very, very challenging issue that she has raised. Probably, I think what it calls for a proactive nature in the bill. Like, we are different cultures and different communities. We live in different ways. In some communities, some societies have a different attitudes to extended family. Some have, the attitudes are not the same. I think we need an approach that will take that into account. It cannot be a matter that is left to luck, because I think I'm worried about what she's saying. But we can't just leave it to luck. We need to say, in this kind of community, and its cultural and value system, how would we take care of that up front? So it's not a matter that depends on a clever and very innovative individuals, if we are to ensure that this remedial intervention leads to, it's just those two or three issues around it. Generally, I think the framework takes care of a number of key elements that are required, and the improvement as we implement will actually take care of itself.
Okay, thank you. DJ? My colleagues are very happy, but they're just embellishing the otherwise wonderful product table for us here. But, I share that sentiment.
Thank you very much, Chair. We will, of course, we take into account all the comments and questions that have been raised, and to the extent that we are still going to get an opportunity to receive more detailed comments during the consultation processes, all of the comments will be taken into account. And then we will finalize the document as I had indicated earlier. But insofar as the reporting, in particular the issues of quarterly reports arising out of this legislation, in the last ISCJ meeting that we held, one of the issues that we looked at was the question of the generation of statistics, the research to support the legislation, and how often do we report to Parliament. And but also not just to report to Parliament, but to report for policy purposes as well. And I think this proposal resonates with the resolution of that meeting, and we will make those reports available. I guess the first few, at the end of this quarter, we have already committed to finalizing a report for this purpose, and we will share that report with Parliament. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. On that note, we move to...
Yesterday I was watching an interview around this child what I think. One member of parliament was asked a question about whether there is any law on trafficking and so on.
And they said there's no law.
And I was worried about that because I saw that member in the same position we were before we were briefed. I didn't want to fight with that member. Right? They were in the same position before we were briefed. Probably what I want to encourage the department is that, and all of us, even us here, that can we just interact so that we're on the same word. Because the intention of the chair doing that briefing, if you remember, was to reassure society that whilst there is a law that is in process, there are measures in place to deal with the greater part of that. And I think because it's good for reassuring society, it's good to ensure that all of us are on the same way to go.
And to suggest that the members should brief their party caucuses.
Yeah.
In terms of people who are here, because we are at this level now. We should each go to the party caucuses and do that. Yeah. Let's go to policy framework on diversion services. Number two. Item number two. On the Oh, you don't have an agenda. Sorry. Bangladesh is keeping all the agendas with me here. You know, this is terrible. I can only read one at a time.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I will be dealing with the policy framework for the accreditation of diversion services in South Africa. Members will recall that in terms of the Act, we're supposed to table this framework in Parliament a month before the commencement of the Act, but we could not do that. So we are planning to table this together with the broader national policy framework on Monday, the 31st. In terms of introduction, this is the outline of the presentation. I'll touch it briefly so that you get the gist of what this policy framework is all about. In terms of introduction, the minister is expected to, in consultation with other cabinet members responsible for justice, education, correctional services, safety and security and health, must create a policy framework to develop the capacity within all levels of government and non-government sector to establish, maintain and develop programs for diversion. Also to establish and maintain a system of accreditation as prescribed and programs for diversion and diversion service providers. Also to ensure the availability of resources to implement such diversion programs. Section 56(2)(g) of the Act also provides for the quality assurance, monitoring and evaluation of such programs and service providers. The purpose of this policy framework really is to serve and protect the needs of children and youth at risk and those in conflict with the law. Ensure diversion service providers and programs comply with minimum norms and standards, because we also have existing minimum norms and standards for diversion. The policy also aims to ensure that there's provision of support through capacity building, the development and implementation of evidence-based practice in the field of criminal justice work, enable and facilitate sustained quality service delivery in the area of diversion, and also facilitate continuous quality improvement for such programs. The objectives of this policy is to ensure that all service providers, DSD employees and relevant stakeholders are aware of and support the DSD approach to quality service in terms of diversion. Also to ensure that there's an appropriate accreditation and quality assurance system for services to children at risk and those that are in conflict with the law. And to ensure that such an accreditation system is well coordinated and characterized by minimum bureaucracy and maximum effectiveness. The scope really of this policy has four tiers: the child at risk or in conflict with the law, the organizational and program level, criminal justice and social services sector, regulatory and policy environment. We have also set out a criteria for accrediting organization in this policy. We are saying that any organization that qualifies for accreditation must meet the following criteria: authority and competence to operate, that is the legal structure and got experience in working with children with offending and difficult behavior. Such an organization should have governing body and or management, because we also are accommodating the community-based organizations. They must also have financial systems and also systems that will ensure proper financial management. The administrative capacity should be there. There should be staff complement that is necessary or that is required to provide such services. We need to make sure that such an organization, be it a community-based or religious organization, they need to be registered as NPO with a department, and maybe also as a welfare organization to provide social services. We're also saying the organization should have at least 6 months experience in working with children with offending or difficult behavior, and or has qualified personnel with 2 to 3 years of relevant experience in the field. With this one, we've also taken into consideration that most organizations are using volunteers. Hence the last bullet that we say, at least if you are using trained volunteers, they need to be supervised by a qualified professional. We have also set up a criteria for accrediting programs themselves. We are saying for any program to be accredited, it needs to at least meet such a criteria like it should have pre-intervention and post-intervention assessment mechanism to measure changes in behavior of those who have access programs. reasonable geographical accessibility to the clients that you need to provide services to. The programs should be age appropriate, in terms of physical and cognitive ability, issue of cultural diversity also, we have included that in the policy framework. Your program should be based on research evidence of what works in reducing criminal behavior, because that's what the aim of the diverging program is all about. Your program should clearly articulate objectives and outcomes. The program design and activities must have factors that are likely to reduce reoffending. It must have a system of monitoring the quality of program delivery. And the program must have an indication of less intensive and most intensive services. All programs should be exposed to regular supervision by senior staff members within the organization. Programs to be managed and supervised by professionals. We have come up with mechanisms for implementation of this policy. We have created or proposed structures at a national level. We are saying we'll have dedicated capacity to manage, monitor, and coordinate the implementation process and maintenance of the national register. We have allocated two officials and the head of social crime prevention at the director level, which will be based at national office. This team will ensure that there's capacity building of service providers at all levels of government and non-government sector. Also, they will support the provincial teams. They will also monitor implementation of this policy framework and accreditation system. They will keep the database of accredited and removed service providers and diversion programs from the register. In terms of the provincial structure, we are recommending three structures or proposing three structures. The first one is the accreditation committee. The second one is the quality assurance panel. The third one is the site verification team. With the accreditation committee, we are proposing that it will compose of 4 to 8 members, which must include civil society members, academics, and experts in the field. They can form a quorum if they are 4+1, and the process we are proposing that need to be led by the head of social crime prevention in the province, which are at the director level. The quality assurance panel, this is well articulated or well outlined in the section 32 of the Child Justice Act regulations, so we didn't change or add much, so it's as it is. It will compose of not less than 3 and not more than 7 members, and civil society members and academics. Members of the panel must have knowledge and experience relating to diversion programs and children's issues. An official employed in the state may also be appointed as a member of this panel. In terms of the site verification team, they need to be composed of 2 to 5 officials from government, including civil society members and academics. We've also make sure that dedicated provincial personnel will have to have this task as part of their job description and work plans, otherwise it won't be done. Then we're coming up to functions of each committee. We tried to make sure that they are really distinct. The accreditation committee really for them is to accreditate qualified service providers and evidence-based programs. They need to analyze activities of the whole system of accreditation of diversion service providers and programs, take part in the development and realization of policy and strategy in the sphere for accreditation of diversion service providers and programs, cyclical accreditation decision making and maintenance of accreditation reviews. We are saying they need to sit twice a year, and within 3 months after receiving the application, they will have to sit. The Act stipulates exactly the time frames in terms of what should be done. They also need to make recommendations to the quality assurance panel. Then the quality assurance panel, they need to prepare documentation and reports reflecting findings and recommendations of quality assurance activities taken, the allowing and considering organizational and program responses to the preliminary reports, monitor and evaluate realization of policy goals and objectives for diversion processes, conduct organizational and programmatic site visits, which include reviews of relevant documentation, interviews of clients, which might include children themselves, parents, and other stakeholders where relevant. The quality assurance panel need to contribute towards the development of capacity and program content of diversion practice. They need to facilitate the development of an organization development plan, which we call an ODP, and assign a mentor for the organization if there are things that need to be improved. The last team, which is the site verification team, this one coordinate and conduct verification and quality assurance site visits and provide written reports thereof. This team works immediately after the submission of an application. They need to conduct preliminary assessment and screening of received applications, make recommendations regarding accreditation or removal of programs and or service providers, keep database of service providers and programs, assist in capacity building of emerging and existing service providers. Because it's this team that will assist if an organization or a program is not accredited. That organization will be referred to this team for them to take through and assist that organization to meet the requirement for accreditation. Nominate members, appointment of those provincial structures. We are saying the National Department of Social Development is primarily responsible for ensuring that this policy framework is implemented and accounted for. The three structures proposed in the policy framework will be identified and appointed by the province considering all requirements stipulated both in the Act and also in the policy framework. The national representative will be an ex-officio member of the accreditation committee. The provincial head of department must appoint members of the three structures, approve, disapprove those from government departments, civil society and representatives from the academic institutions, preferably on recommendation of the accreditation coordinator, who is the head of the social crime in each province. Members should have knowledge and understanding of cultural diversity and knowledge of the service within the broader criminal child justice system. The accreditation process itself, we have proposed three phases. The phase one is basically the application process, where it's open to all service providers expressing that they should express a need to be accredited. Then application is done in person or online. We do have an electronic system and also a manual system to accommodate those that won't have access to computers. A self-assessment material will be issued upon receipt of intent. Submission of self-assessment material prior to a pre-treatment closing date needs to be received within the department. That is basically phase one. Phase two, what happens there is desk assessment of application. Then the site verification team comes in. They need to do site visits and verify the documentation that they've received and the information contained in that application through a visit. Then they confirm the candidacy status, whether this is a candidate for accreditation or not. Then they make a recommendation for accreditation or not for accreditation to the accreditation committee. Then phase three, that's where the accreditation kicks in. Then the accreditation team consider recommendations made by the verification site visit team, and they make a decision. When the accreditation is denied, a service provider is referred to a site verification team for further assistance, because it's not just only denied, we need to assist them to make sure that they comply with the requirements or with the criteria for accreditation. Service provider is informed of decision taken by this committee, and then also service provider received the certificate for accreditation if the accreditation is granted. And then service provider is also placed in a quality assurance cycle so that the quality assurance panel can schedule visits to be able to monitor the implementation of the program. That is just a schematic diagram, I'll jump it, talking to the phases that I've just alluded to. We've also, in the policy framework, proposed complaints and conflict resolution mechanism. We are giving a responsibility to the HODs to handle complaints from aggrieved service providers. Service providers are expected to lodge complaint in writing within 7 days of receipt of response from the accreditation team. Then the HOD will have to investigate and respond to the complaint within 30 calendar days of receipt of the complaint. The final outcome of the complaint will be sent to National Office of DSD for recording purposes, because we need to keep the database also. Then matters of conduct and conflict from committees may be handled by respective coordinators which are at a director level. Only upon failure to resolve such can be referred to the HOD. We are saying in terms of resource implications, we envisage that nominated members and or subject specialists must be identified and recruited from other government departments, academic institutions and civil society as part of those three structures that we have proposed. Provinces also have been requested to avail existing personnel and tools to assist with the processes of these teams. Continuous capacity building of service providers at all levels of government and non-government sector. The National Department of Social Development to provide implementation support using existing resources. In terms of recommendation, Honorable Chair, we recommend that the committee note the progress thus far and make inputs on the proposed policy framework. Note and support that the draft policy framework and accreditation system for diversion services be tabled in Parliament on the 31st of May 2010 as per requirement of the Child Justice Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam. Members? There's a board with which we can put our teeth into it. We don't have to do it for the sake of. If it's an excellent document, we just nod our heads. Honorable JJ.
Look, I might have, but
who is making the decision to accredit? You've got these structures, but they've got responsibilities, but you know, functions of the accreditation committee, make recommendations to the quality assurance panel. I can't see, under the functions of quality assurance panel, that they're taking the decision. Because ultimately, it's the in terms of the Act, it's the minister, the national minister, who must issue a prescribed certificate of accreditation to each diversion program and diversion service provider that is accredited. So I see the appeals are to the head of department provincially, but I just want greater clarity as to who's taking the decisions. And if it's effectively because of the Act, the national minister who's issuing the certificates, really to the national department, are you protecting the minister sufficiently for decisions that could be being taken elsewhere that the minister has no say over? That would be the main one. The other one would be once you've appointed, when are you going to appoint all these structures, and can we get detail as to who's on the structures? If you can just let us know about that, and then maybe just while on the floor on this issue, I mean, and the social development had said okay, they should have tabled this before the Act came into effect, but they've chosen to table it now. There's another body here, and they have got representatives that was meant to do something before the Act came into effect, and they couldn't do it. Maybe they can tell us how far they are. That's the SAPS and the what do they call the national instructions?
All right, let's start
with SAPS.
You want to
tell them, please? Thank you, Chair. Yes, obviously we did not table the national instructions in time before the coming into operation of the legislation. The reason being we were waiting for the finalization of the regulations. Now, the national instruction has been tabled in Parliament on the 26th of March. That was, in fact, before the Act came into operation, but not the 30 days before the Act came into operation. So the national instruction was before Parliament for a period of 30 days, and we are now in the process of publishing the national instruction in the Government Gazette as required by the Act.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I will start with the last one. We are planning to finalize the point. Provinces are busy currently putting systems in place, but we said to them they mustn't rush because we need to get approval first in terms of the finalization of the policy, but we gave them a date of the 15th of June. So we'll be giving the committee the names, the details of who sits in those three committees for each province. In terms of the decision of accreditation is given currently in the policy framework to the accreditation committee. They are the ones who make a decision in terms of denying or granting accreditation committee, considering all the other processes. We have taken note of the fact that the Act speaks to the Minister and the Minister, but I think committee members will appreciate that social development implements through its provinces. So what we have also requested legal opinion on is in terms of the delegations of the Act itself, because we can't function at a national level. We can only do what we have proposed in terms of making sure that we manage, coordinate, and monitor the implementation of the policy framework itself. So all other services that are delivered within social development, even though the minister takes the overall accountability, but is delivered at the provincial level, what we need to do to finalize it or tighten up the delegation issues to make sure that that is formally done. But monitoring, still national will be responsible for monitoring. In terms of issuing the certificate, even if you look at the policy framework itself, the framework of the certificate we have attached, it still speaks to the Minister of Social Development. So once the delegations are finalized, we will be able to change that to the MEC, because now the Minister will have to delegate to the MEC. But currently, if you look at it, it's MEC. It's Minister of Social Development. But we know that it won't be possible. Otherwise, it will take time if the Minister will have to sign all certificates for the 9 provinces. So we are finalizing that process also. Even at the last DGICCJ meeting, that was also discussed in terms of the delegations, whether what process we need to follow, because obviously we can't do it at a national level. I don't know if I've left something.
Okay, there's an appeal process if the accreditation is rejected. That has to be there, obviously. But what about an appeal process if accreditation is granted and somebody from the public wants to complain about the fact that you've accredited a program which they don't feel is accurate? Should there not be provision for that, for a process for that? What happens if there are complaints and you may have covered this all already, I don't know, but if there's you accredit a program, you have your general verification and checking on it. But is there a mechanism for it comes to the attention of us, a member of the public or whoever, that a particular program, the kids, instead of sitting in class doing something, are actually just roaming the streets when they should be doing something else? Is there a complaints mechanism process and also a process to de-accredit? So I think you've dealt adequately with the accreditation process and the appeals if that was rejected. But what about the other side of the coin, where there may be complaints about the accreditation committee that they shouldn't have accredited a program, and there should be some kind of process to oppose that? And then if in the course of the implementation problems emerge, how do those get dealt with? And is there a process of de-accreditation that is outside your standard general checking processes?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. I think we did not include that one of public complaining. So we can add it there, but we have a quality assurance panel which will be monitoring, after we've accredited, which will be monitoring the functioning of the organization itself and the running of the program. But a community member might see things that maybe the quality assurance panel might not have identified. So I think it's important that we include that clause to make sure that the community member or the any member who discovers something can have a direct link in terms of where to report, so that the quality assurance team can visit or make sure that a decision is taken. There is provision for for the lack of a better word, after we have accredited, if there's things are not going on well, we can take or revoke the certificate also.
Okay,
in addition to that, I mean, maybe there should be specific provision for the minister and the MEC to be able to instruct the Quality Assurance Committee to investigate something, or for the minister even to on a temporary basis, or the MEC, ministers delegated, to suspend. I'm just raising it because programs can come and they can sound good and they can look good, but then when they're being implemented, things can go horribly wrong, and you want the ability to be able to stop them immediately. And rather than a long, drawn-out process where children are still in this program. So I'd really suggest that. And one other point, it would also be useful when the figures are there to get reports of the numbers of programs and the geographical coverage. So if you are in Dundee, Mutu, or one of those places, and you're a child in trouble with the law, are the programs that can take you up? Because remember, these programs have to be where the kids live. So your geographical coverage would be useful, and the kind of programs.
Thank you. Well, I take those to be just additions. They don't require responses. It seems to me like you are done with this part, and I want to thank you most sincerely for availing yourselves. We are better informed, and as agreed, we'll go to our party caucuses and ensure that we become part of the program. But I've been listening to radio stations, and so there's lots of talk around this issue. So there is a lot of work going on around educating the public and so on. And I thank you very much again, and members shall remain because we need to do something else. We have a report to adopt. The department and you are excused. Thank you very much. Yeah? Sorry? No, you can say that. What's the road?
No, I'm not going to